Have you noticed anything different about the winter this year? Was it a bit warmer than usual in your area? And do you know what you can do to battle some of the changes in climate and how this will all benefit fish populations in your area? Today we have an expert on to talk about what they are doing to help protect habitats in the Mississippi Basin and how this can apply directly to you this year. This is the Wet Fly Swing Podcast, where we show you the best places to travel to for fly fishing, how to find the best resources and tools to prepare for that big trip, and what you can do to give back to the fish species you all love. Hey, I'm Dave, host of the Wet Fly Swing Podcast. I've been fly fishing since I was a little kid. I grew up around a fly shop and have created one of the largest fly fishing podcasts in this country. I've also interviewed more of the greatest fly anglers than just about any show in the world. Today, Carol Abrahamson, Executive Director of the Mississippi Valley Conservancy, is here to shed light on what they are doing to help protect farmlands and native habitats for future generations. You will get the three biggest takeaways today, including discovering how farming can actually help fish populations, why native plants are more resilient to changes in climate, and why larger corridors of the natural habitat areas are the focus of the Conservancy here. Plus, we're going to share an Emmy Award-winning video that tells the story and history of the geology of the Driftless area. This is amazing. Can't wait to share this one with you. Is there anything bigger than protecting the habitats of our native species? Let's find out how they do it. Here we go. Carol Abrahamson from the Mississippi Valley Conservancy.org. How you doing, Carol?
I'm doing great, Dave, and thank you so much for this opportunity.
Yeah, I appreciate you putting some time aside today to talk about an important part of the world and some things you have going on out there. We're doing this big event right now that we just kicked off with the Driftless Angler and a bunch of great partners, and you're the main group that we're trying to support from the conservation, and you're doing some awesome stuff. We've heard the Driftless has been an area I've heard a ton about over the years. It seems like it's this really unique area, so we're going to talk about that. But take us back before we jump into there and tell us how you got into this world of kind of where you're at, conservation and conservancies and all that stuff.
Yeah, well, it's been an interesting journey. Conservation was not in my background. I actually trained as a nurse, but then went into farming with my husband, raised my family, did some other things with farm industries. But eventually, I saw this opportunity for a full circle in my life in that, you know, on our farm here, we use conservation practices and we rotationally graze our cattle. And so a move toward the conservancy and conservation work just fit in really well with our lifestyle.
That's amazing. Yeah. So I love that. And I love the farm. And I saw some of that in your bio. I think it's really great because you hear a lot about that, right? Ag, right? And just how some of the practices that aren't the best. So maybe just give us a little snippet on that a little bit. Is that something that anybody can change up if they have a small farm or big farm, or is this more locally just as kind of smaller, kind of small acreage type farms, the stuff you do there?
You know, we actually do focus our conservation efforts on farms. So we have a lot of people who you work on your farm for 40, 50 years. You put a lot of time into it. And then as you age, you realize, well, you know, either maybe you don't have kids or your kids aren't interested in farming. So what's going to happen to your farm when you pass? And that's when they give Mississippi Valley Conservancy a call and say, hey, we'd really like to see this protected because we don't want it to be turned into, you know, a rock quarry or a subdivision or have our forests clear cut. So that's where we can help them by protecting their farm with a conservation easement. And that's just an agreement between the conservancy and the landowner that extinguishes future development rights. And they continue to farm, own their property, they can sell it, all of the things. It just can't be further developed.
So does that work in kind of indefinitely? Like what if that landowner sells it eventually? Is that conservation easement always part of the contract or whatever?
Yes, actually, it's recorded with the deed. So all of our work is in perpetuity, which is why this is such a wonderful opportunity to just let people know about what we're doing, because what we do today will last forever. Many generations to come will benefit from our work.
Wow, That's super powerful. I mean, so that's it. And the cool thing is that obviously farming is an important part of, just life, right? We have to have food. So, but I think it's more the challenge. Like, how would you take, maybe talk about that a little bit. How would you take a farm? What would be some farm practices that aren't the best, and how would you tweak them so they're actually more focused on kind of protection of species and habitats?
Well, because we do focus on the rivers that flow into the Mississippi, those are our priority areas for protection. We're looking to farmers who are interested in protecting those streams. So, for instance, if they previously were planting row crops right up to the stream bank, we're encouraging them to put in a buffer strip and have some permanent either prairie or hay, some permanent vegetation that can buffer any kind of runoff waters into that stream. So we can help connect landowners with conservation practices as well as resources because it's expensive and, farmers are always struggling with their expenses. So that's part of what we do. But quite frankly, folks that come to us usually are already doing really great sustainable farming, and they have a lot of habitat on their farms because here in the Driftless area, we don't have hundreds and hundreds of acres of flat open fields. So every farm has forest. They often have some land that they've already planted into prairie or some sort of permanent grass. And that benefits birds, greatly benefits birds. And then a lot of them do have wetlands or they have a stream flowing through their farm. And again, they have some conservation practices that they have put in place to protect that water.
Amazing. Yeah, that's kind of the forest. Yeah, forest farms, fish, it's all tied together. And it's cool about the drifts because we have heard about that. And I'm excited to get up there because we're going to be there this fall, and it'll be my first time in the area. But maybe describe that. Do you know a little about, maybe for those that don't know, why the Driftless? Why isn't these giant farm fields like you'd see down in south into, other parts of the plains or whatever? What makes you the Driftless unique?
Well, when the last glaciers came through, they went around this area. So it didn't get flattened out. And so we have these beautiful valleys and wonderful bluffs and the karst topography, bluffs that overlook the Mississippi River, beautiful scenic views all along the roads that you would drive in the Driftless area. It is a very unique area of the United States and of the world. And a lot of people don't know about it because it isn't a very big area. So, gosh, I hope when you're here, we can give you a tour of one of our nature preserves.
Yeah, that would be awesome. I'd love that. I think I'm you're definitely excited. We're gonna have a small crew of people that are gonna be out there as well, kind of fishing. And that's the great thing about this is that we're gonna be focusing on some streams, and I'm sure these are probably tributaries that are nearby, the area you're working. But so maybe talk about that, a few of the projects you're working on. I think you've mentioned a few of them already, but what do you spend your time, what does your team kind of spend their time working on as far as projects?
Yeah, well, like I said, we do focus, our priority areas are the rivers that run into the Mississippi River. And we work with all landowners. I do want to point that out. It isn't just farmers, but all landowners. But the other thing that we do that is a really big benefit to the public is occasionally we acquire land. So we purchase land. And we do that in a really thoughtful way because, of course, we only have, so many funds and capacity to do the work. What we are focusing on is building larger corridors of protected land that will be more resilient and hold more biodiversity as we try to work through this changing climate that, has become very apparent this winter to all of us. And so one of the projects that we completed last summer, super, super exciting project for us. It was an opportunity to purchase a rather small parcel for us, but a really important connection. So we purchased 17 acres along the Kickapoo River. The reason that this was so important is because it is adjacent to the 8,600 acres that is protected at the Kickapoo Valley Reserve, and it was the only remaining private property along an 18-mile stretch of the Kickapoo River that wasn't protected. So now we have this 18-mile stretch that is protected forever. It is not going to be developed. Nothing is going to be able to disturb that water. So that was a very, very exciting project for us.
And that's on the, and the Kickapoo is a tributary. So these are all tributaries to the Mississippi. They eventually flow into the Mississippi.
Yeah. The rivers and streams that we work on primarily all will eventually flow into the Mississippi. Yes.
Gotcha. And this section, this 18-mile section of river is basically it's protected forever. And then what will you do to that property? What else will you do? Or is it just good enough just to protect it and don't allow any development there?
Yeah, in this circumstance, what we are going to do is we're working right now to turn this 17 acres over to the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. And they already own 8,600 acres. It makes more sense as a partnership to, it will be protected by us with the conservation easement. So, you know, they would not, of course, they wouldn't develop it, but they wouldn't develop it if they so chose to. But it will then allow them to bring it into the work that they're already doing on restoration and making sure that if there are any issues along the river, that those are addressed. A lot of times, if we're able to purchase a property, protect it with a conservation easement, and hand it over to a partner, it helps us with the long-term restoration costs on a property. So we do that when we can. Partnerships are fantastic. We get more work done with partners.
Right. And who are some of the other partners you, I mean, it sounds like you work with a lot of private landowners. Who would be some of the other partners you work with, like on these types of projects?
Well, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, for sure. And in fact, they did do some surveys on Hay Valley Creek, which flows into the Kickapoo River, this parcel that we're talking about. And they did confirm that there are populations of brook and brown trout there, as well as other fish. But, you know, that was just exciting. So, yeah, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has always been a great partner of ours, including providing some of the funding when we purchase properties. But we do have another really exciting project that we closed on in early 2022, the largest acquisition that we have ever made. And that was a 1,600-acre property. It has 5 miles of the Kickapoo flowing on it, as well as 2.5 miles of Plum Creek, which is a class one trout stream. So this was a farm that had been farmed pretty heavily. So we will have a lot of stream bank restoration to do on this property over the years, as well as other restoration on the land, converting some of the farm fields into habitat, stopping the erosion that's going on right now. Really, we are enhancing this property for the forest interior nesting birds. But all of the work that we do on this property will greatly benefit the water quality, because right now, where there have been cattle that have been grazing in places that aren't sustainable and row cropping where it's not sustainable, you know, that all causes erosion into the rivers. So we're super excited about that. That was a great partnership with the Nature Conservancy, as well as, Trout Unlimited has helped us with that one, and the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. The Savannah Institute, they are a group who focuses on restoration and looking at unique ways that we might work on restoration. So they're helping us with a management plan on this property. And then we couldn't have done this. This was a over $3 million project without a wonderful anonymous donor who stepped up to pledge the $30 million for the property. So, you know, we count on individuals for a lot of our work. And individual support. And, when I say an anonymous donor, $3 million, and you think, well, I can't do that. Well, of course, not everybody can, but I'm saying a $10 contribution still goes a long way in the work that we do. And so support at any level is greatly appreciated.
Perfect. No, that is great. Yeah, $3 million, and I love the like anything helps. Do you also do some events? Could people in the area get involved, and if they didn't have money to donate, like just actually help out in volunteering?
Oh, absolutely. That is a great question. If you go to our website, MississippiValleyConservancy.org, and you click on, I believe it's ways to get involved, I think it's that simple, you can see all of our volunteer opportunities there. And they are constantly being updated. And you can fill out a form that tells us, I do not want to go out and cut, brush, and pull garlic mustard, but I would love to come and help you with a mailing in the office so that we can target those opportunities to what you would like to do. But we can use help in all realms of our work, and we greatly appreciate our volunteers. So, absolutely, that's another way to get involved. And we have our annual member and friends gathering coming up at the end of the month, the 23rd. It's a Saturday morning. We have a great speaker coming, Barrett Klein from UWL, and he's the bug guy extraordinaire. So that's going to be really fun. And that event is on our website. So again, people can go check that out. And it's a member gathering, but it's open to everybody. So we love that friends come and learn more about us.
Waters West Fly Fishing Outfitters is your go-to resource for swung fly techniques, two-handed casting, and anadromous fish. Find out why Waters West has built a cult-like following around their fly tying materials and why they are the go-to resource for the OP and beyond. You can head over to wetflyswing.com/waterswest right now to check in with Ed and Kyle and get all geared up to get on the water. Today's episode is sponsored by Togan's Fly Shop, who provides superior quality products at an affordable price, an amazing resource for fly tying materials, tools, and fishing accessories. Since 2005, Togan's has been over-delivering on price, service, and passion, and now you can check out that Togan's buzz for yourself. Right now, you can head over to wetflyswing.com/togans to get started. That's T-O-G-E-N-S. You support this podcast by clicking through that link to Togan's online. And going back to that project, the I think it was a 1,600-acre property. So on the stream, so it sounds like a few of the things you do, stream bank restoration, kind of farm to habitat, and dealing with erosion, is and that's mainly to decrease the amount of sediment, fine sediment in the rivers that kind of impacts fish. Are there other species that's also benefiting?
Yeah, primarily the sediment that impacts the temperature of the water. We need to have those deeper streams to keep the cold streams, especially for the trout and all fish. But also, absolutely, there's benefits to the frogs, the turtles, all of the insects that thrive in the wetlands that are near these streams. So it goes back to biodiversity, which is so important. Again, in the face of climate change, that is one of the things that we are working on every day. And when we're adding, whether we're planting trees or restoring prairies, we're always thinking about biodiversity.
Nice. And the climate change, I think, is a tough one, right? Because it's a hard one because it's so big. And I'm sure a lot of people, we've talked a lot about that on the podcast, whether that's warmer temperatures or, snow change, and all that, snowpack changes. I mean, what have you seen out in your area? Is that mainly what you've seen, just temperatures and, not the same as they used to be and things like that?
Yes, I think that we've all realized the 2023 was a record warm year. And now here we are, January, February, March, all looking to be record months in the new year as well. I don't know that any of us have ever experienced a winter like we've had here in the Midwest, where we essentially have had, I don't know, maybe half the snowfall that we should have. And very few cold days. And this week we went into it right here in My farm is in Minnesota, but right here in Wisconsin, Minnesota, we went into this new year with a drought. Last summer, we had a severe drought, and now we aren't getting the kind of moisture that we usually get. So we got a little rain yesterday. Fingers crossed that that will turn around. But with these high temperatures, wind, we're not catching up on the moisture, and that's going to be a big problem. But again, really important that we focus on the native species of plants. When you look at prairie plants where they may have root systems that are 6, 12, 20 feet deep, they can reach down to that moisture and thrive, whereas, shallow-rooted plants just aren't going to do that.
Gotcha. So, and that's part of this is that the if you can get more native plants recolonizing these areas, they are probably better suited to deal with changes in climate than, say, a row crop. Is that kind of what it looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. If you're going to have drought after drought after drought, it's going to be more and more difficult for a farmer to plant, say, corn and soy and keep it going. We saw devastating effects last summer with that. But the other thing is, we really encourage cover crops because what we have seen this winter with little to no snow, and then we get these windy days. Well, there goes your topsoil. So, it's complicated and there are so many things. But I just want to remind people though that it's not hopeless by any means. The work that we do is called natural climate solutions. So protecting land from development is extremely helpful because carbon is not being released. When you dig up the soil, you cut down a tree, you pull out the plants, that all releases carbon. So if you don't do those things, you don't develop a piece of land, then all that carbon stays sequestered. But there are things that everybody can do. Just think of the little things that you can do to make a difference. Put in a few more native plants in your garden. Compost your food waste. If possible, look into heat pumps and solar. The incentives right now are really fantastic. Try to buy your food locally so that you have less of a carbon footprint in purchasing, but also you're supporting a local farmer. So many things that you can do. And if you really want to get into it, of course, we need to change policy. So people who are interested in that kind of advocacy work, it's always welcome.
Yeah, nice.
And I would be remiss to say, support your local land trust.
That's right. It always goes back to that because I think that that always comes up, the climate change and what do you do? And it feels like we're stuck because these little things sometimes don't feel like they do much. But I really think that, we've had stuff like this happen in the past and it feels like it is the little things, whether it's Rachel Carson with Silent Spring or any of these other people that started as a small group, and it became this movement. And so, yeah, I think those are great reminders for us. And I'm just thinking too, I go back again, history, and I don't even know. I think the Dust Bowl, right, which I think occurred because of over just that period of time. But I'm guessing things recovered from that too. I think they, do you know much about, I know that's kind of south down. Do you know much about that history? Have you ever looked at that whole part of our, the US when we had the Dust Bowl occurred?
Well, yeah, I had done some reading, but interestingly enough, the Plum Creek Conservation Area, the 1600 acre property I was talking about along Plum Creek and the Kickapoo River, we have had some students from UWL doing some core borings down there along the stream banks, trying to actually get down to the original soil. And they've not been able to do it. There's been that much erosion. And that would come from both dry years and years of flood and sediment along those stream banks that so far, and I believe they've cored down, I don't know, 12 or to 20 feet and not hitting the original soils. So that's the impact, that we feel and that we have to deal with. So when you start to think about how do we restore that stream bank, it's going to take a lot of work and, of course, a lot of resources to do that. But that's what happens with, say, a Dust Bowl year where the soil is dried out and it's hot and it's windy. That soil's going to go somewhere. I mean, there's been instances of soil from, I believe it was Iowa, ending up in Minneapolis area. And that was, they had a derecho, if I say that correctly. And that those high winds lifted that soil and took it all the way up to Minneapolis.
Right. Gosh. Yeah, this is some, I guess some of this is, you know, definitely higher level stuff and we're not going deep into this, but it kind of gives a, you know, just a primer on some of the issues that are out there. And going back to that bank, so what would that be, you know, is the type of work you're doing if you have a really a bank that's eroding, kind of sloping it back, planting vegetation, and is that kind of what it looks like? Or maybe describe that a little bit, how you would stabilize those banks.
Yes, you nailed it. You want to slope the banks back, get permanent vegetation planted. That allows when there is a year of heavy rains and there's flooding, it allows that water to rise up gently over those sloped banks where that vegetation is that's holding the soil in place. And then as the water recedes, it just slowly recedes back down. Those banks are stabilized and they stay in place. And we have seen this because we did have some pretty terrible floods in some years past. We had a landowner who did exactly what I just described with a stream on his property, and the results were amazing. You could see on his property where he had done that work, how that water had just gently flowed back down. There was no erosion. The grasses had laid down, but of course they pop back up later. And then further downstream where work had not been completed, we saw those banks erode and you get those steeper, you know, banks and more slough off of the soil.
Right, right, right. And then, like you said, then that just goes to decrease the habitat and more impacts. Okay. Yeah. And then a few of the other things you mentioned. So that, and then what would be the habitat? So if you had that farmland and you wanted to create some native, is that more just, yeah, changing that farm back to native plants and then figuring out what species are there that you want to protect? Or is that a big project to figure out which plants and how do you restore the farm?
You know, we look at the historical plants and trees that were on any property that we are working to restore. And so, yes, a farm field, a field that right now is being row cropped, we're either going to reforest it because that's what it originally was, or plant it back into prairie because that's what it originally was. The 1,600 acre Plum Creek Conservation Area, again, we're focused very much on forest interior nesting birds. So we're looking at doing a lot of tree plantings there. In fact, this spring, we are going to be planting 2,000 trees as just the beginning of our work on that property.
There you go. Nice. And I'm just looking at some of your programs. And yeah, you have a bunch. I mean, one of them, the Link to the Land, looks like you have a bunch of events around, yeah, handcrafting tools, migratory birds, bats, mushroom foray, right? So this sounds like, is this something that another cool program that's pretty popular, the Link to the Land?
Link to the Land is a series that we have throughout the year. Those are all guided hikes or events. And the one coming up, this is going to be very interesting. We have a landowner who not only makes his own bows and arrows, but he also makes the hand tools to make the bows and arrows. So super interesting. I mean, he goes back to prehistoric times where he's making these tools out of, you know, flint and the right kind of the right kind of wood, and then making the bows and arrows. And he actually hunts with them. He has nice. Yes, he has hunted, I think, elk and I know bear, deer, of course.
Yeah, sounds like a cool guy.
Yeah, yeah. So that's going to be really interesting. We're excited to have that happen. But yes, during the course of the year, you can keep your eye on the website and you will see all of our guided hikes where they're at. We do a migratory bird hike on International Migratory Bird Day. We have a cave. We have a property that has what was a commercial cavern on it. And we opened that up a couple times during the summer. We conserved this property for the bats that need this cave to hibernate in the winter. But in the summer, when the bats aren't in there, we open it up a couple of times for tours. So that's another opportunity to see something kind of unique. Our mushroom forays are always very popular. People like to get out and learn about the mushrooms that grow in this area. and be able to identify some of them.
Wow. Yeah. A ton of stuff going on.
Yeah.
And so you talked about the guided hike program. I think that is, and there's a ton. If you go to your website, I think that is the take home. And if people go there, can they just sign up to the newsletter? Is that a good way to keep track of what you have going?
Yeah, absolutely. We do two e-news per month. That keeps people up to date on everything. And then we have a spring newsletter, a fall newsletter, and our annual report that are printed, and we can mail those to you. But I really suggest people sign up for that e-news. It'll keep you up to date on everything that's happening.
Okay. And one more item I saw up there I was curious about was the Bio Blitz. Is that something that's similar to the Link to the Land, or is that a completely different program?
Yeah, that is a different program. We're sort of partners in supporting that. There's another group that actually runs the Bio Blitz, the Nature Place, but we help in promoting it and encouraging people to get out and take part.
Good. And that's basically getting out and just having people out collecting data, right, on species, whether that's fish or like anything out there. Is that kind of what the idea is?
Yes, absolutely. Yep. The more people that go out and identify plants, animals, birds, insects, fish, anything, and then get that all reported in. It's just helpful.
Get ready to explore the wild with Northern Rockies Adventures. Imagine yourself surrounded by pristine waters, towering mountains, and the thrill of landing a trophy fish like the majestic Arctic grayling or the elusive bull trout. With over 40 years' experience guiding anglers through these breathtaking landscapes, Daniel's family-operated trips promise not just a fishing journey, but an adventure of a lifetime. From the convenience of Vancouver, BC, dive into an all-inclusive experience that caters to every detail of your trip so you can focus on the thrill of each hookup. Take a look for yourself at nradventures.com/wetflyswing and discover the Northern Rockies like never before. That's N as in Northern, R as in Rockies, adventures.com. You support this podcast by checking in at nradventures.com. So anything else we're missing? I know we're leaving a lot on the table as far as the programs you do, but anything high level you want to highlight, projects, anything that we missed today?
You know, I was going to mention one more recent project, and that was, again, like I said, building larger corridors of protected land. We had an opportunity to add to our Devil's Backbone property, and this is a property in Grant County. This is a state natural area that we already owned, and then a landowner adjacent to it offered to sell us his, I believe it was 40 acres. But this also a really important stream protection project. So this is Chase Creek, which flows through some steep, brushy valleys down into the Mississippi. It's just a really gorgeous property, and the stream has brook trout in it, so that's exciting. So just another opportunity again to build another corridor and to protect some more of our precious streams and rivers right here in the very unique Driftless area.
Yeah, this is great. And well, let's start to take it out of here. We have our little kind of our fun facts segment. So we've been talking about a few things, but maybe think about that. Is there, as I get into this, is there a fun fact? I always love hearing some, whether it's the Driftless or what you do or any other partners that we can kind of highlight as today's fun fact. But this one today is presented by the Driftless Angler. Of course, they're our sponsor on this big trip we're doing. So Jerry and Matt at the Driftless Angler, they have this great program. And also the cool thing is Jason Randall, who's another local kind of expert angler, is going to be helping out on the trip. So first of all, do you have a fun fact, anything coming? I know I'm putting you on the spot here, but anything coming to mind that you could about the area or anything you guys have going?
Oh, goodness gracious. You know what? I can direct you to a video that we have. It's an Emmy Award-winning video called
Oh,
Mysteries.
perfect.
Yeah, it's called Mysteries of the Driftless. So here's a fun fact. We have an Emmy Award-winning video called Mysteries of the Driftless. It has aired on PBS a number of times, as well as some of our local stations, but you can find that on our YouTube channel. So
Perfect.
Mississippi Valley Conservancy's YouTube channel, Mysteries of the Driftless. And that movie does explain a lot about the science behind the Driftless area.
Nice. Yeah, that's the perfect fun fact. So Emmy award winning the movie. This is cool. So we'll have that in the show notes so people can check out. I'm going to take a look at that one for sure. So that's checked off the box. And then, you know, I guess, you know, again, today, looking back at it from what we've talked about, you know, like we said, it's been a lot of high level stuff. Are there any takeaways you would leave people with as they're kind of starting to think about heading out here today? Any from what we talked about or anything we missed, like what would you want those action items to be for somebody listening or the things you want them to remember?
I would love for everybody to go to our website, click on Nature Preserves, and find a property that you'd like to spend some time on. And then go on out there if you want to go by yourself and have a peaceful little retreat, or maybe you want to grab the kiddos or a friend or a neighbor, but just get outside and enjoy nature. It's amazing and it's restorative.
And are those nature preserves, are those for the most part places where people just public, well, they're not public, but they're, how does that work? You know, most of these places people can just go on without any worry of, you know, running into anybody that's going to tell them, you know, they aren't accessible.
Yeah, that's correct. So they are owned by us at Mississippi Valley Conservancy. But we open them to the public. So they're open for hunting, fishing, trapping, birding, hiking, snowshoeing. If you click on the nature preserve, it tells you about the property. It tells you allowable uses on the property. It gives you directions how to get there, where to park. And then there's a trail map as well.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, I'm looking at them now. This is really cool. Apple Valley Bluff, Black River Bottoms. This is, yes, tons and lots of stuff. And I can just see the photos on here. They look amazing. So this is getting us a little take on the area. Good. So I'll put a link as well to those so people can take a look. And again, I think the cool thing is people, you know, not only locally around there, but probably as people are traveling around the country, you know, this summer, this fall, you know, I'm guessing that part of the country, did you see a lot of travelers through your area that are kind of, you know, just kind of coming from other states and stopping by to check out the area?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. La Crosse is an area that people tend to come and visit anyway. La Crosse is a beautiful little city, but they absolutely, right there above overlooking La Crosse, you know, we have the La Crosse Blufflands, which is one of those nature preserves that you can click on. There's all kinds of trails, beautiful overlooks over the city and over the Mississippi River. But also, you know, we cover 9 counties and most of them are more rural. Any kind of habitat that you're interested in, whether it's going to be a bluff, a forest, a prairie, a wetland, a stream, they're all a part of our nature preserves. So you can pick what's most interesting to you and enjoy it.
I see that. And yeah, and I see La Crosse. So La Crosse is kind of the larger city just up kind of northwest from Viroqua, which is where the fly shop is that we're going to be at. And so is Viroqua, what is that from you? Is that about an hour drive or less?
Yeah, it's a little less than an hour. And near Viroqua, we have Tunnelville Cliffs. That's an amazing property. It's nearly 1,000 acres of all sorts of habitat types. So if you're in the Viroqua area, check out Tunnelville Cliffs.
Oh, great. So this is the double. This is cool because we haven't done this before to this extent, but I think we're going to take like a family road trip out there with the kids, drive all the way out. We're actually on the West Coast. So we're going to do a Western States and make our way to this trip. And so we're going to have time, I think, to actually explore. So I'll definitely be picking your brain more about some of these places to check out.
Sounds oh, that's really cool. Exciting. Yeah. And you have kids.
Yeah. We 10 and 12. So they're
perfect.
Definitely fired up.
Yeah, perfect. They'll love to get outside. And you'll notice those nature preserves, there's a scavenger hunt that goes with each one of them. And that's, I mean, obviously adults can enjoy scavenger hunts, but the kiddos really love that scavenger hunt. So it's an opportunity for them to be looking for things as they're hiking. It keeps them
that's
busy
perfect.
And engaged. Yeah.
They love that stuff. Okay, good. So we have that covered. And again, we'll just send everybody out if there's questions or you know, want to connect to Mississippi Valley Conservancy. But let's do our quick little random takeaway out of here, and this will be easy and quick. But the first one I always like to talk about, we talked about the farm. So what is your, as a farm owner, you know, what is your biggest tip today you would tell somebody else who maybe has a small farm or maybe wants to get started to help protect their habitats? Is there one thing they can think about today?
Start small. if you're just getting started, don't overwhelm yourself. You know, focus on one thing, start small, visit some other small farmers and learn before you jump in it.
Yeah, That's a good tip. Nice. And what do you guys, what are your farm? If we go to your farm, are you, is there all sorts of, you know, food and animals, or how does that look? Take us there a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. My passion in life is to grow most of the food that we eat. So we have a small beef herd. So we rotationally graze cows and their calves. But we also will raise out a few steers. And next month, I'll be picking up 50 baby chicks and 4 baby pigs. And so then we'll have our beef, our pork, and our chicken for our family, and then also for some customers. And then I have a very large vegetable garden, some berries, and a fruit orchard. And so I'll spend the summer preserving food, and we will eat well year round.
Wow. Yeah. So you have it covered. And how does that look in the, I guess, in a typical winter time where things were super cold? How has that been? Has it been, or the now that the winters are a little more mild? I mean, when was the last really bad, super heavy winter you had where it was really cold and nasty?
Well, up until this winter, we've had some, you know, the typical snowfall and some polar vortexes, you know, some really cold days. But this winter, so I try to keep a little bit of my garden going as far into the fall as I can. I did my last garden harvest of lettuce, spinach, cilantro, radishes, and onions on January 4th.
Right, which is abnormal.
That's unheard of. Yeah, that's unheard of. Never. I don't know that I've ever even made it to December in the past. And now, the other day, I did go ahead and lay down some lettuce and radish and beets and carrots, you know, a small plot just to experiment to see if it'll grow. But again, totally unheard of.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. And what is your, as far as, you know, outdoor activity? I'm not sure if you have ever done any fishing or hunting or anything like that. Do you have an outdoor activity you love to do?
Yes. I love to be outside. I love to hike, but I'm a triathlete. So I participate in triathlons and adventure racing.
Oh, wow. Adventure racing?
Yeah. Adventure racing is a combination of orienteering. So it'll be acres and acres, you know, hundreds of acres of land. You'll cover many, many miles in an adventure race. They're actually based on time. So it might be like an 8-hour race, a 12-hour race, or if you get into expedition races, they're many days, but you are using a map and a compass, and you are looking for checkpoints that are out in the wilderness. And you're doing that either by trekking, you know, hiking, and mountain biking and canoeing. And so you do all three of those things, and you might cover, you know, 100 miles in a race easily. But they're based on time. They're super fun. They're really hard. They're a big challenge, Especially for somebody who's definitely on the older side like me. but you are outside all day and, you know, possibly into the evening, depending on the length of your race, and in all conditions. It doesn't matter if it's snowing, it doesn't matter if it's raining, the race does not get called off. You just do it.
Right. Wow. That sounds really awesome. And challenging. I mean, I'm thinking, I remember when I was getting into trail running a little bit, thinking those folks that were doing like 100-mile runs, I always thought like, wow, that was intense. But this is kind of similar on the similar lines. It's just a big, long, long day or multi-day event where you're typically, are you ever running or is it more like trekking, stuff like that?
You know, we'll do a little bit of, you're carrying a pack because it's a self-support.
Oh, right.
Yeah. You're carrying a pack with all, you have to have, you know, all of your safety equipment and your first aid kit, as well as all of your food and your water too. So yeah, we'll do a little bit of, you know, kind of the young fast teams. They're going to be running.
They are. So they're actually running.
Yeah. They'll be running for a good chunk of it, but you know, I'm the 60 something, so I'm not doing a lot of
running. That's right. That's right.
And mountain biking's new to me. I'm still learning that. So, you know, I'm not going to be racing down big hills either. I can take my time and not fall and break a bone.
Yeah, I hear you. God, that's awesome. No, it sounds like you're really into it. This is cool. So I'll have to look into that a little bit, adventure racing. And the last one we'll leave it here with is just on the music or podcast question. Do you listen to more music or podcasts when you're out on a road trip?
Oh, I'm a podcaster all the way.
Oh, nice.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Nice. Can you give us a little insight? Do you have any podcasts you really love or anything out there? Or what's the type of podcast do you listen to?
Yeah, so a couple, all things food. So like the Sportful, Milk Street Kitchen, those kinds of food ones, because I am a foodie. And then right now I'm really geeking out on Dateline because I love a murder mystery.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right.
And then
those are super popular. Yeah.
Yeah. And there are a couple of adventure racing podcasts that I listen to as well.
Okay. Good. All right, Carol. Well, I think we'll leave it there and we'll follow up with you here. It's going to be later this year. I'll be heading out there. We'll check in with you and we'll send everybody out to Mississippi Valley Conservancy.org to follow up and everything we talked about. And I just want to thank you for all the great work you're doing in the local area and your staff and everything. I know you have a nice, a large staff and some great folks there. So yeah, excited to keep in touch with you. And thanks again for all the time today.
Thank you. We really do appreciate this type of support is important. So thank you, Dave.
There we go. If you want to get a chance to go on this fly fishing trip we talked about, we're giving away a trip, but we're also allowing a few spots for people that want to head out to this part of the country and hit the Driftless Dry Fly School. You can check it out right now, wetflyswing.com/driftlessdry. That's Driftless Dry right now, and you can check, enter your name there and email, and we'll let you know if we have any remaining spots. We should have a few right now if you get in early. You can also check in. We just launched the giveaway for this Driftless Dry Fly School at wetflyswing.com/giveaway. And it's going to be a huge one. I'm going to be out there. I'm going to be traveling across the country doing a podcast road trip. And I'm going to be meeting everybody out there this fall. And I want to share with you the next episode we have coming before we get out of here. The next episode is a solo bonus episode coming up tomorrow. This is on fishing super small flies. I put this together as summarizing a podcast we did with Ed Angle quite a bit ago. And these are the 5 tips on why and how you can fish dry fly, actually not just dry flies, but small flies in the wintertime. And this is a real good one. So check that out tomorrow, a quick little snippet episode. I'd love to hear if you're liking those short snippets. You can check in with me anytime on that. And if I haven't heard from you yet, send me an email right now, dave@wetflyswing.com. I always love getting new emails from listeners, or if it's been a while, definitely check in with me. It's the easiest way for me to connect with you because it is impossible for me to know you're out there if we haven't talked yet unless you check in. All right, I'm going to let you get out of here, and I want to thank you for stopping by today and hope you have a great morning, a great afternoon, or a great evening wherever in the country you are. And I look forward to seeing you on that next podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.